For the week of April the 4th, 2016, this is Current Federal Tax Developments. This week, we're going to take a look at a few things, including when code sections collide. We're going to be dealing with the interaction of two different partnership anti-abuse rules when they both apply to a transaction. We're going to take a look at the case where we discovered the defining of value, where a bankruptcy trustee saw nothing but junk, end up creating self-employment income for the taxpayer. We'll also look at a case where actions taken by the trustees of the trust after the decedent's passing had consequences that reduced the estate's charitable contribution deduction. Also look at a case of same facts, same results. Another IRA bites the dust despite new ideas that were presented to the court about how to keep the IRA alive in a transaction that was virtually identical to that in the Peak case decided back a few years earlier. And a reminder regarding the rules when you reimburse a single employee's private health insurance. Current Federal Tax Developments is brought to you by Nichols Patrick CP Incorporated and your state society of CPAs. We want to make sure that you understand that your state societies and Nichols Patrick both are looking at giving you education regarding tax matters as we come up in the coming year. And you want to be sure to consider your state society when looking at planning your CPE time. In case you weren't aware of it, hey, time's ticking down now. And I overskipped myself there, those of you watching the video, but we actually have a nice little picture here. So, you know, if you're not watching the video, we have a nice clock here reminding you that, hey, we're in April. And so time is tacking down on the tax season. So I know many of you are kind of rushed these days for time. So I understand if maybe you're listening to this in the background or you're doing it some other way, or you're actually listening to this after April the 18th. But we'll talk to you about what's been going on and how things are working. And we're going to start this week with the first case in line is going to take a look actually at a set of private letter rulings. These are private letter rulings 2016-13-001, 002, and 003 that were issued on March the 28th. And they look at the interaction of a pair of rules. That is, we have the situation of a partnership where the partnership interest was sold. And it was sold in a transaction where the loss was disallowed to the seller under the related party rules of 707B1 cap A. This particular partnership, a couple things were true about it. Number one, the partnership had not made an election under section 754 to adjust the basis of assets. So there was none of that in the background, nor was one made for this year. And secondly, the partnership we're going to discover here had a little problem here. That is, it had a substantial built-in loss, which under 743, even without a 754 election, is going to require an adjustment of basis to assets inside the partnership. Why is that a problem? Well, under 707, the rules of 707B1A, we sold the interest to the other partner, to the new partner, and we incurred a loss. So let's say that our basis in the interest or our basis in the interest was $100,000. We sold it for $50,000 to the other party. The other party's basis in that interest is $50,000. However, under the special related party rules, if that asset that was sold for which the loss was disallowed is later sold by this individual, if there is a gain, they can offset the gain up to that built-in loss amount. Well, that's great, except, of course, we have a partnership here. Okay, so the partnership interest gets adjusted. Well, that's fine. And with no 754 election, we might not care too much because the basis of all the assets in the partnership stay where they are. But in this case, the partnership had, if you may remember the special rules that Congress had a few years back under 743, where if a partnership has a substantial built-in loss, and that is in the aggregate, the basis of all the assets of the partnership have a fair value. That is more than $250,000 less than the aggregate basis. And again, I don't care just about that 5% interest this guy bought. We're looking at the 100% interest. If that major built-in loss exists in the partnership, then if there is a transaction to which 743 would apply if the election had been made, you have to go ahead and reduce the basis of assets. So this set out a kind of a double whammy. The problem is, we didn't get to recognize the loss. When the seller sold the interest, there was no loss recognized. However, the buyer has to take, in essence, internally, the partnership's going to write down the assets. So if we sell one of those assets, the buyer is going to end up recognizing a gain based upon that disallowed loss, their gain will be increased. Well, that seems unfair. So these rulings ask, is there some solution here? Can we go ahead and use that built-in loss against the 754 adjustment that will be generated if there's a later sale? And the IRS did rule in this case that the deferred loss could offset the gain on sales of assets inside the partnership to the extent they had been adjusted down by a disallowed loss. So if the partnership computes a 754 adjustment, we then have what you might say an adjustment to the 754 adjustment that'll reduce that back down by the gain, by the loss that was disallowed, that's allowed to offset the gain of the asset inside the partnership. Now, that seems like the right answer, certainly seems like the one we want, but you can certainly understand why the partners in this case, and it appears there were three of them, did want to get a ruling to back this up, because the other way of interpreting this would mean it would sit outside with their interest forever, and that may mean it would never really be able to be used, creating a very unfair situation. So essentially, this tells us how to deal with this, at least in this particular context. It's a decent interpretation of how this situation should be resolved. Moving on to our next little case. This one's a little more interesting. This is the case of Reither versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2016-56, issued on March the 28th. And this gentleman owned a corporation that fabricated items out of steel. And as it did that fabrication, the corporation generated scrap, some of which was pretty substantial. The corporation really had nothing to do with that scrap, but it kept it. So it had this giant pile of scrap it kept building up. Now, what happened in this case was we got to 2008, and you may remember the economy took a little nosedive at that point. The corporation ends up being liquidated in bankruptcy under Chapter 7. But the bankruptcy trustee looked at that pile of scrap and decided it had no real worth, and he just abandoned it. So the corporation's gone. There's a pile of abandoned scrap sitting on this lot that this guy owns, and his company's gone. He's basically out of work. So he's looking for some way to get money to live on. And he begins to wonder if that big pile of scrap might be worth something. Well, as you might guess, any of you who've ever worked in the scrap metal, who've had clients in scrap metal, yeah, it's worth money. There's a very active market in scrap metal. So what he starts doing is he took the scrap. He decided, well, I've got this scrap. I'm going to go ahead, and as I need money, I'm going to sell the scrap off. So he took the scrap, and he sold it to get money. He reported the money as ordinary income. That's not our problem. The problem was the IRS, when they examined him, said, well, this is all well and good, but we think this is self-employment income. It relates to a trade or business. You know, you were the company was selling scrap iron. If you have property held for the sale, if it's property you sell at a gain that is held in the ordinary course of business for sales to customers, is considered not exempt. The gain is not exempt from self-employment taxes. The question became, was this scrap iron being sold, held for sale to customers in the ordinary course of business? And the court had to try to take a look at this. And what the court decided was that, well, there's not really a simple way of analyzing this previously under the law, because it's not often you just kind of inherit a pile of scrap iron out of the blue. And the court did note in a footnote that, you know, you might wonder if maybe he shouldn't have had income when the scrap iron came to him, but they said nobody's worrying about that, so we're not going to. So put that off to the side. If you do have a client who basically takes over a pile of scrap iron, the court's told you that there might be another issue, but nobody raised it here. And they said, well, let's take a look at this. And what the court decided to do was it said, well, maybe the best way to determine is to see, is he in the trader business and is this inventory? Well, this issue comes up quite often under Section 1221, which is the capital gain or loss section. And it comes up when we're trying to figure out whether you sold an asset. For instance, quite often this involves land. Is somebody a developer or an investor in land? Developers have ordinary income when they sell the land. Investors have capital gain. And as the court pointed out, the key difference there was the same definition. Was that property held in the course of business for sale to customers? And it said, you know what? We really should conduct much the same analysis. So the court said, we want to take a look at the factors. The factors you look at there are the frequency and regularity of the sales, the substantiality of the sales, the length of time the property was held, the segregation of the property from any of the taxpayer's other business property, the purpose of the acquisition of the property, how much sales and advertising effort there is, time and effort spent on the sales, and how the proceeds were used. It also said we have to determine also for self-employment tax, was a taxpayer engaged in a trade or business? And if so, is this property used in that trade or business? The court did point out that the taxpayer would not be tainted by the trade or business of the corporation. The taxpayer was not the corporation. So he took it over. It said it was very similar to inheriting property from an estate. You don't, you know, if the property in the estate was used for some purpose, we then look at what the estate used the property for, not what the decedent used the property for. The court found in this case that he really wasn't acting like the trade or business. They said, A, he acquired this stuff by accident. Essentially, it was there. It was abandoned. He took it. It's a very ready market. There's not much work he has to do to sell this stuff except decide to sell it. It pointed out that, in fact, he did not take the money when he sold this to acquire more scrap, which if you're in the trade or business, they'd expect him to do. And he didn't actually go out there. You know, customers didn't come in and buy scrap from him off the streets. He basically decided when to go sell it. For all these reasons, the court found that he was not liable for self-employment tax because this was not part of a trade or business. Next up, we're going to talk about an estate case. This is the estate of Deringer versus Commissioner, 146 TC number 8, issued on March 30th. And this is a case that involves a charitable contribution. And at first glance, it seems fairly simple. The decedent in this case owned a majority interest in a corporation. And by the terms of her will and trust, she left it effectively to a private foundation. The private foundation qualified under 501c3. So it seems pretty easy. And in fact, her estate, essentially, everything in her estate was left to either other charities or this foundation. So at first glance, this seems pretty easy. You know, the corporation is valued, the stock is valued on the day she dies. And then in theory, of course, we're going to get a deduction. So the stock is in the estate, but we're going to get an offsetting and equal deduction when we transfer it to the trust. And normally, that's the way these things work. Because as the court notes in this case, normally, absent an election under Section 2032, which is basically the alternate valuation date election, when you take the charitable contribution in this case under 2055, the value of the contribution is going to be set by the value of the asset. When we have a contribution of an asset like this, that was included in the decedent's estate. But in this case, a few things happened. Before the transfer of the stock to the foundation, the corporation elected S status. And then it also decided to redeem the stock that she had held, all the voting stock and a portion of the non-voting stock. And finally, it issued new stock under subscriptions to her sons who previously held a minority interest in the corporation. Now, you might think, okay, that sounds bad, but hey, there's some good facts. And the court agreed there were valid business reasons for everything that was done. And the court actually outlines those valid reasons for making the S election. There was a valid reason for the S. It actually put the charity in a better position to be a creditor rather than an equity holder for getting its money back out. And effectively, it allowed for a lot of, you know, easier management, et cetera. So there was all kinds of good business reasons for this. But the court pointed out there was a problem. Despite the valid business reasons, the court noted that the two valuations, the valuation of the estate when she died in April, the corporation's valuation had been valued as a majority interest. She had control of the corporation. It was a majority interest. There were no discounts, right? Makes perfect sense. There wouldn't be. She's a majority interest holder. However, in December, when this S election was done and when the redemption plan was adopted, the valuation then came in, and in that valuation, they had taken effectively a 50% discount, treating it as a minority interest. Now, the brothers had argued, well, it was a really bad year. 2009 was bad. This was a real estate management company. It was really bad in real estate around then, and admittedly, that's true. That was not a good time to be in real estate. But the court noted that, A, it really wasn't sure that December was that much worse than April. Remember, everything fell apart back in 2008. So by April of 2009, things had crashed down pretty far. So while it may have gotten worse by December, it hadn't gotten as much worse as this drop in value that they redeemed the stock at. The court also was very troubled by the fact that while we had this majority interest, we had valued it to redeem it, which essentially is the money the Suns are going to have to come up with to pay through the corporation to buy the stock back. We had used a minority interest discounts and take a 50% hit. The court found because of that, the actual charitable contribution to the estate would only be that reduced value that was part of the redemption, not the value at the date of her death. As you might guess, that's going to create quite a bit of estate tax in this case. That's where our problem came. Next up, we're going to take a look at Thiessen versus Commissioner, 146 TC number 7 on the 29th of March. And this is kind of a how to blow up an IRA yet again. The issue in this case, and this may sound familiar to you, the taxpayer got funds from retiring from Kroger, and he took those funds. Actually, he quit Kroger because he would have had to move to a different state. Kroger was transferring his position elsewhere, so he left the company, had his retirement funds. He wanted to acquire a business. He found a gentleman, a business broker who had previously talked to a taxpayer we've talked about before in the case of Peek versus Commissioner. Though this was the same business broker. And he said, wait, we can go ahead and we can use your retirement fund money to buy this. We're going to take your retirement fund money. We're going to put it in an IRA. And then we're going to form a corporation in the IRA. And then the corporation will acquire the company that you wanted to buy. As was true before. So basically, here's the catch. So the corporation's funded. It goes out. It finds a company to buy, which, by the way, this broker had. Not surprisingly. This broker then, you know, we get the sale done. Now, we're not going to pay cash because there's not enough cash to buy the whole company, so we had to sign a note. Thiessen guarantees the note. Just like we did in Price, or I should say, just like we did in Peak, the problem is guaranteeing the note, per the case, is deemed by the court to be an indirect extension of credit to the IRA. Under the prohibited transaction rules of Section 4975, if you have a loaning between the beneficiary of the IRA and the IRA, and that's either borrow from the IRA or lend to the IRA directly or indirectly, that is a prohibited transaction. You effectively destroy the IRA. It is treated as totally distributed on the date on which the IRA, on which basically the first day of the year, in which this prohibited transaction takes effect. Now, these facts are virtually identical to Peak. By the way, the interesting aside, his CPA tax advisor was also the same tax advisor as Peak. So these, and he had been referred to these people by another person who participated in these. So we don't know how many of these transactions were involved by this group, but apparently there's at least three of them that we now know of. And when we went, so he went back, he got this done. Now our problem is we have identical facts to Peak. We're back in the tax court. Not surprisingly, you end up getting the same result. But you might wonder, I noted this was a published tax court decision. Published tax court decisions are supposed to decide new law. If we're just applying the Peak case, shouldn't this be a memo case? Well, that would be true generally, except the taxpayer tried two other ways of getting around the problem. Unfortunately for the taxpayer, neither one worked. First, the taxpayer found there is a provision here in 4975 that says there is a workout provision here. If where we have this particular issue under 4975D23, you have to dig down a ways. If a transaction, is a prohibited transaction, if it's corrected within the correction period, a transaction in connection with the acquisition, holding, or disposition of any security or commodity can be corrected. So you have that 1 year correction period. He's saying, well, that's what this is. This is in connection with my acquisition of the stock in this company. We should have 1 year. The IRS should have given us 1 year effectively to correct this, in which case then we could undo the transaction, not blow up the IRA. The court said, no. So your problem wasn't acquiring the stock. In fact, the courts ruled now that that's not a probative transaction. Rather, the problem was guaranteeing the debt of the corporation, which was not related to the acquisition of the security. It was rather related to the operation of the company. Different problem, different probative transaction, no relief there. Well, they tried a second tax saying, well, we should be let out of this because the court had never decided these, you know, self-directed IRA engaging in these types of transaction cases before we entered in the transaction. And the court said, tough luck there. Congress, when they passed the law, established the law and its effective date. You don't get to wait till the first court case comes by before you have to follow the law. Therefore, the court found that the IRA, just as in peak, was blown up on the first day of the year in which they guaranteed the debt. Finally, this week, we're going to talk about an IRS information letter, 2016-005. And this is just a reminder to you. A constituent had written to the congressman or asked the congressman now asked the IRS, if he could reimburse the private insurance policy for his sole employee or did that violate the Affordable Care Act. Now, you may remember, normally we can't reimburse private insurance for employees, going back to Notice 2013-54. If you're looking at the slide, those of you look at the slide, at the video version, it says 2015, should say 1354. Normally, the answer is yes. Because under 2013-54's notice, it tells us that, in fact, this represents an impermissible plan and a $100 per day penalty. However, the rules of the ACA in this area do not cover a plan that covers fewer than two current employees at the beginning of the year. So if you're reimbursing only your single employee and their private insurance plan, you do not trigger the $100 per day penalty. However, the plan still does have to meet the requirements of Revenue Ruling 61-146 to be excludable from income. That is, you have to make sure that you prove you reimburse the money directly, either pay the insurance or require receipts and proof of payment back. But if you do that and it's a single employee, then you can cover it. Danger, obviously, is if you get a second employee, you better change your structure as soon as that happens, because the beginning of the next year, when there are two employees sitting there, you've got to have some other program in place or no program in place. This has been the current federal tax developments for the week of April the 4th, 2016. Be sure to visit us at www.currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com, where we have the information and all the citations for this week, and you can find links to all the cases. We have write-ups of all the cases. You also will find there, if you go onto the videos page, that will have a link back to a PDF version of all the write-ups we did this week. So if you want to take one, print it out, you know, have this week, or even, you know, print it out and follow along as we do this video. If you want to do that, we do them each week. You can get those documents. Also, be sure to check with your state society of CPAs. Those catalogs should be coming out here as we get to the beginning of or the end of tax season. Take a look. Be sure to look at there to find our courses and the courses of others that'll be offering here, our live courses here for the state societies. And we look forward to seeing you next week when we talk to you some more about what's been going on in the area of federal taxes.